Hi, Bill DeYoung here. It's Arts Alive, the St. Pete Catalyst podcast. I'm here today once again with Paul Wilburn, the executive director of the Palladium Theater in St. Petersburg, Florida, author and so many wonderful things. Hey, buddy.
Bill, good to see you.
It's good to see you, too. We were just talking that we haven't really crossed paths in a while. You would think that since we have about a million of the same friends and a lot of the same kind of interests and activities that we would, but where have you been?
I'm not going anywhere anymore, Bill. I just stay home, try to write books and run the Palladium. I don't know. I do feel like I have been to every party I ever need to go to, and I'm kind of trying to work on my creative efforts and my job.
Well, one of the things we're here to talk to you today about is, of course, Cigar City, Tales from a 1980 Creative Ghetto, your book about Ybor City, set in Ybor City in the delightful debauched 80s, is 5 years old. And you've been doing some events to sort of trumpet that a bit. And we're going to talk about that. Also want to talk about the Capital campaign, which is still in motion over at the Palladium.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and you have a new book, which I think we're going to chat about a little bit. Charlie. I knew that. I was just being stupid.
You were trying to have fun.
Yeah, anyway. So listen, let's start here. St. Petersburg Opera Company is at the Palladium Theater starting this weekend, Friday, Sunday, and Tuesday. I learned back in the day that they take a day off so those people can rest their voices.
That's the secret.
St. Pete Opera is, I guess, about 20 years old now. I mean, they've been around for a while, and they have been at the Palladium for as long as I can remember. Why is the Palladium perfect for what Maestro Sforzini and his incredible company put on? It fits like a glove to me. You know, I never saw them anywhere but the Palladium. And it goes hand in glove, you know?
It's because they haven't done a main stage show anywhere but the Palladium. Mm. They were born at the Palladium before I got there, working with a previous executive director who saw the potential in it and helped them with real breaks on the rent and really made it work for them. And Mark Sforzini, the maestro, fell in love with the acoustics and the intimacy. Mm-hmm. You know, so many operas are performed in 2,000-seat halls and are bigger, and this is so intimate. I remember the first opera I saw, I think, was La Boheme, and they brought a marching band up through the vomitorium, that little stairway up in the middle of the thing, and it was incredible. I'm sitting right next to this marching band, and they've loved that intimacy. And so they're the biggest clients we have. We build our season schedule around their season and then fill in after that. So they're very important to us.
They pretty much sell out. It's usually pretty hard to get tickets, especially for the earlier parts of this run. Samson and Delilah, which is Friday, well, as we said, Friday, Sunday, and Tuesday. There's no orchestra pit. And I can remember talking with Sforzini about the fact, well, you know, one of the things that nobody's terribly crazy about is he's conducting the band, as it were, behind the set,
right?
You know, on this stage. And I think everything's done via closed circuit. And is that ever going to change? When we start talking about the Capital campaign, you're not going to put an orchestra pit in there.
Can't dig one down because the ceiling is just, there's just no depth. We've got it's a church basement underneath is the side door nightclub. And, you know, we could sink it down, have no side door nightclub, but that would not be good.
You know, I guess I should have taken that into consideration that there goes the side door.
Right. But, Bill, yeah. I will say,
yeah,
we are going to take out the old pipe organ, and we're going to gain the whole organ loft and a raised area that can hold at least 50. It might be that you could put your players there. It's also the stage is going to get even deeper. Mark has had a good run using that. It sounds great. Often it looks great, and the sets have worked well.
And I'm not saying there's a problem with it. It always felt the orchestra. It felt a little tight when you'd kind of go back there before they shushed you and told you to leave.
Yeah, but have you ever been in a pit? It's pretty damn tight.
Only looking at it.
Yeah, it's tight.
So the pipe organ's going. Was that there when the church is 100 years old next year? Is that correct?
Yeah.
The pipe organ has been there that whole time.
Yeah, and it was at one point a famous, well-respected pipe organ. But it got, over the years, it's been, let's say, altered, and it's no longer, it has a name called Skinner, which is a very famous one. Mm-hmm. It's the parts aren't worth that much. There are 5 or 6 really top-notch pipe organs around this area where people perform, and I think ours has been used in the 16 years or so I've been there once. it's going to go to make room for a lot more stuff, and we're going to save some of the pipes for beautiful decor.
Isn't you can't sell it? It's like, is there a big hot market for vintage pipe organs?
Not really. We may be able to sell out some parts of it, and as I can't really sell it. I can have someone take it out and give it away. We're a state institution. I don't sell things particularly. It's gonna be carefully removed, and some parts of it will be used elsewhere.
It was 2008, 2007 when you took over?
August of 2007.
Okay.
And the college also acquired the Leeper Ratner Museum around that time. I'm not exactly sure the first year, but all that stuff happened around that era.
So St. Pete College, they wouldn't be interested in selling this organ to make a few bucks. I just want to, in other words, they're all in on this renovation that you're talking about. And
colleges don't really, that's not really how we're set up. You don't sell stuff. I don't sell T-shirts. There's all sorts of tax things.
Let's talk about the capital campaign. You're here. It's been not quite a year, but almost. And you were talking about you need to raise $10 million. Can we go over again what it is you want to do? You're improving acoustics. You're improving sight lines. You're getting rid of the 100-year-old seats.
Yeah, seating, sight line, and acoustics. You hit it, Bill.
Okay.
And really, all the work is up in the 800-seat main hall, and which we use for multi-purpose. It's a great hall for acoustic music. It's going to be a better hall for acoustic music when we finish. It's not a great hall when you get a loud band and drums and everything.
I remember you telling me that.
So
how do you fix? Okay, I'll just play dumb because I don't know. How do you fix that?
Well, what you want is to make the room softer. And part of that, one of the worst things we have is a plaster ceiling. And above that plaster ceiling is 12 feet of attic with steel beams.
Hmm.
And so the solution our architects and design folks have come up with is to take out that plaster ceiling and drop an acoustic, looks like an opera house kind of ceiling.
Sure.
That'll let the sound go up and be caught in there, in this 12-foot attic. And we'll also, when we get real loud bands, we'll be able to drop curtains from that ceiling that'll be above sight lines, but will also deaden the room. The window treatments will deaden the room. And so we'll be able to turn from a really nice acoustic room into a that's very bright, which you want, to a really dead acoustic amplified room. And we have to do that. We often do that one night after another. So,
but you just said, okay, I just want to be clear because you said a really light acoustic, a bright acoustic room, which you want, to a really dead acoustic room. And see, that to me sounds like that's no good.
Well, maybe dead's the wrong term. It's dry. My guys use dry and wet, and I don't really want to go into that metaphor.
Sounds like the Dateline I watched last night.
Yeah, it sounds too crazy.
Yeah.
But what works for opera and chamber music is the exact opposite of what works for amplified music. And mm-hmm. so these changes will allow us to sort of dial the room up for what we've got. And we're going to get brand new seats realigned to the stage, new window treatments. The stage will come up a little bit. We're going to re-rake the balcony. It seems like a lot, seems like not a lot, but it costs a lot of money to do these things. And that's why we're raising money to do it.
Also talking about, as we were, the side door cabaret, I guess it's a cool room, but there isn't that much you can really do with it, I would think.
I mean, it would be a different project just because we've got to do this project first. But the side door, if I could take out those two pillars right there and run a support beam across, I think it would make the room a lot better. So, and we want to improve the bathrooms down there, some other things, but that will be a follow-up project.
Okay, so we won't talk about that. Well, I mean, if you took the pillars out, wouldn't the whole Huff Hall auditorium collapse?
That is not what we're looking for.
That's a bad idea.
But I have seen, there are places, and I think even Studio 620 and others, who removed support beams but put support beams across the top. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to do it. Whether we can pull that off or not, we don't know yet. We haven't really studied it. We just know what we'd like to have.
$10 million. How long is that going to take? Where are we in the process?
Well, we've had a great run. We've raised almost $9 million through various sources, including at least five through private sources. And we're going to continue. We're just really starting to kick in our private fundraising. But the city's supporting us. We've got a TDC tourist development tax application that's been approved. The county commission still has to vote on it. The city council still has to vote on the city funding. And we've got $1,850,000 over the last two budget cycles from the state. So it's been a really, been lucky that things have happened. And the latest state grant comes with a ticking clock to spend it. So that's kind of pushing our timetable, which is good. We want to start because the longer you delay in this type of market, it costs you a lot of money per month to delay.
Your money from the state is not from the other fund where everybody kind of got skunked this year.
No. We don't even go after that money. To me, it's
I didn't think so.
It's too much paperwork for too little money. Mm. And our budget request talked about economic development and education.
Mm-hmm.
So
what are we looking at time-wise? If you got $9 million already, aren't you getting close?
Well, we're getting close. We're also just, we really want to start next summer, mm-hmm. and it's going to take 9 to 12 months to complete.
Will you be closed for 9 to 12 months?
Certainly upstairs, very likely downstairs too, because once you're in a major construction site, so we're still figuring out how we deal with that.
Yeah.
But we're planning to keep functioning, at least the staff functioning, and figuring out what we do from there. We may do some remote stuff. It's all kind of, right now we're so focused on just getting this project started that we still haven't figured out all this other ramifications.
Well, it's very encouraging that it's going to happen. That
people are supporting it, and it's a good cause. It's a good effort. We're coming to people saying it's a one-time thing. We're not going to come back to you next year. It's going to lower our cost of doing business and bring us more business. So we're already in the black, so we'll be... It'll make us even better and not cost us more money per year to run.
You were a journalist for a very long time and a screenwriter and various sort of creative hats that you wore. And so it wasn't terribly surprising to those who know you that you wrote Cigar City when you did and that you've come out since with Florida Hustle. I wanted to talk about your first book because it won the gold for fiction at the Florida Book Awards in 2019 for somebody's first work, which is pretty amazing. Playing devil's advocate, though, it's an amazing book. Why is 5 years something to celebrate?
Well, actually, I got that award, which kind of just blew my mind, because when you're sending out short stories, you get a lot of rejections early on.
Yeah.
And to get that award really reaffirmed a lot of good stuff, because I didn't know if I was a writer of that kind anyway. But I got the word of that in January of 2020. And so I was the first book that St. Pete Press published. Mm-hmm. And it was not a real pretty book. I got to say, there were errors, and St. Pete Press has gotten so much better. And, Amy Chianci wasn't there. So by this time, in January, we said, let's do a new edition.
Yeah.
It came out in March of 2020. And if you remember March of 2020, the world shut down. And I was used to public appearances, so there were no public appearances, and the book kind of tanked at that point.
Right.
Because I didn't really know how to market it online. I've learned a lot about online marketing now, but at that point, so the book never really got its due. We put out a beautiful new edition with new photographs. It looks better with a gold medal on the cover, and nobody really saw it because of the pandemic. So I thought, 5th anniversary. Let's give it some legs.
Aha.
That's why we're really making a noise about the 5th anniversary.
So is the first edition like a collector's item now? You got the one with the typos.
Yeah,
in
you
it,
got the one, the ugly one with the pictures that are too small. I really like the gold medal edition, and people like the book. And so we've been doing some fun things to celebrate. We've done a couple of things already, and we've got several more coming up.
I happen to have a list here.
Oh.
October, I read, brings a spate of celebratory events. You've done a couple of these, as you say, already. October the 2nd at Book and Bottle, it's an author happy hour, which means essentially they're signing books and drinking
smiling
wine.
Yeah. There's not a reading. It's not a big thing, but it'll be fun. I like that place. I wrote a lot of my second book at Book and Bottle.
I like Book and Bottle.
I do too.
Yeah. I wish they'd invite me for an author happy hour. Are you listening?
I'll throw your name out
there. Yeah, throw my name out there. Anyway, on the 10th of October, this is interesting. It's at the Florida Museum of Photographic Arts in Ybor City, one of our favorite places. Not only are you going to be there and I suspect sign books, but you and your lovely wife, Eugenie Bondurant, are going to be doing readings from the book. So is that something where you went to her and said, you have a nicer voice than I do, and you're cool, and everybody likes you. Why don't you come and help me with this?
It's absolutely the way it is, because I go to a lot of author talks, and the author talks for 45 minutes, then reads for 15 minutes. It's the same voice, the same timbre. And I'm blessed with having a really talented wife with a great voice. She's the voice of the Dalí.
Yeah.
And many other things, and movies and things. So she loves it. So, yeah, I do the talking. She does the readings, and you get a little break, and she's an actor, so it's good. And so at FOMOPA, the photo museum has a show around Ybor photographs, so it's a natural tie-in.
Tell me about the photographs in the book, because I know they aren't yours, but they come from... Right.
The cover photos, the guy who was the real Pied Piper of Ybor for us was a photographer named Bud Lee, mm-hmm. who shot for Esquire and Life and all those things. And he died. One of the impetus to write the book was he died in 2015. And so I used Bud's photos on the cover, and my dear friend David Audette shot. He was part of our group, and he shot an incredible black and white. So every story has a black and white from that era illustrated, even though they're not literally illustrations.
Did you use the photos as sort of jumping off points or inspiration for what you wrote?
Actually, this I makes wrote the stories. Think of,
yeah. And he came up with photographs. This looks cool. This would work.
I came up with 9 story ideas, essentially wrote them. I talked to David during the process, and he was pulling photos, but not so much I had the stories, and we found photos that I thought matched them. Yeah,
and so, Kismet, it worked.
It worked.
It worked.
And he had hundreds and hundreds of photos. So it's worked out good. And I just thought it was a fun way to do it. But I didn't want to tell the literal story of that era because it was just been too, rote. These are all fictional stories.
Mm-hmm.
There's not, I challenge people to say, oh, that's me or that's them, because there are a few real characters, but they're very minor. All the characters are fictionalized versions of various people.
When you wrote Cigar City, I know you've been interested in creative writing for quite a while. I mean, was this something where you said, I'm not ready to try a novel yet. I'm doing short stories. I'm doing something that I vaguely know. Ybor City in the 80s.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at a lot of authors, what do they start with? Short stories.
Mm.
And to me, I didn't have a novel. I had 9 or 10 stories that I thought really... That's just the way it came into my head as a short story project. And novels scared me to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought this was a way to dip my toes in the water. And so it worked out well in that I learned a lot. And then the next one was a novel. And that was a screenplay I had started but never finished and put bones and skin and things on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's Flora Hustle, which has done incredibly well as well. Let's finish our itinerary before we go there.
Let's get through.
October 22nd would have been my mom's birthday. You're at Tombolo. You're outdoors in the patio area.
And what we're doing there that's unusual, and we're doing in November as well, is music.
Yeah.
Eugenie will read one of the stories from the book all the way through, but before it and at every break in the story, my little band and some friends and musicians will do songs. So you'll get a whole story, but you also get 10 or 12 songs. And they want to do something in the patio to sort of celebrate fall and that it's nice. And so it'll be fun.
What kind of songs? I mean, what are you just pulling them out of the hat? Are they you wrote? Are they related?
No. I'm not a songwriter. Mm-hmm. I wrote funny novelty songs, but we're in the pandemic. My friend Robin Sebokow, who's an incredible guitarist, and his wife was a band singer. My wife's a singer. We had done a lot of stuff. We got together and put together a little band, and I got to say, most of the songs are sort of 80s and 70s songs we like with a lot of harmony,
mm-hmm.
But they're not necessarily songs you always think of.
Do you do Afternoon Delight?
No, refuse to do that.
Thank you.
Song.
Thank you, Paul.
We try to do songs that you might not know. Or like you said, oh, that's so-and-so.
The Pinellas Vocal Band.
We don't. And
she'll read, you're not reading.
I'm not reading. She'll read the story.
Yeah.
And we'll play songs. And I'm going to have Jeremy Carter, the saxophone player, will sit in with us. I've got another singer, Ryan Hill, who's mm-hmm. with Dirty Johns, is going to sing. So it's going to be a mix of folks. And we're doing the same thing in November at the New Tampa.
The New Tampa Performing Arts Center. I think Keith Arsenault told us about this. It's on the 10th of November,
Sunday matinee.
So the exact same thing. Tell me about this band. I mean, I think I saw you somewhere, the four of you doing something. It was very nice. It feels like friends singing together.
Yeah, it was when the pandemic, our neighborhood put together a thing called a front porch concert, and people sat in the yards, and you performed on the front porch, and there were four bands, and we did my front porch.
Oh, yeah.
And so we ended up calling ourselves the Front Porch Picnic, and the singing is good, the playing is good, but we haven't tried to take this. This is not a band we take out that much. We'll do these things. We're happy to play at home and occasionally do a gig.
It's funny how it changes. You know, frankly, the older you get and the more stuff you've got going on in life when you're younger and you're in a band, it's like, I want to play, man. I want everybody to hear us. I do it now. It's fun.
I used to play, you know, three sets in a night, and I stood at my piano and danced with a six-piece band and danced all night. Now I like one set sitting down.
I could just see you doing that Jerry Lee Lewis stuff with your foot.
Yeah.
You have a new, Florida Hustle it's at least a year old now.
It's 20, came out 22.
Okay. So you've got a new one in the hopper that is not out yet, but will be. And this is the one about organized crime in Tampa. Go ahead. Yeah, go tell us about it again.
Well, it's another realistic fantasy where you take something real and fictionalize it, which I tend to like. And Charlie Wall was a real guy who at one point in the 20s and 30s, he controlled Bolita. He was from a wealthy family, but he was the black sheep. And he was called the White Shadow. There have been books written about his murder, his life.
A real guy in Tampa.
A real guy. And Ace Atkins has written a beautiful book about his murder, which happened in 1955.
He was the Bolita king.
Yeah, he was the king. But he also, you know, we talk about crooked elections, which are, that's totally not, when you want crooked elections, look at Tampa in the 20s and 30s. Charlie owned five precincts, and he owned U.S. senators, he owned the governor, he owned the mayor, the police chief. I mean, owned him in the sense that they all looked away from gambling and other things that he was doing, bootlegging and those kind of things.
He was like Don Corleone had all his politicians in his pocket.
Everybody got an envelope, and Charlie was the best one.
Yeah.
And his family knew all those people, so he was, you know, a guy who spoke their language.
Yeah.
And in the real life of Charlie Wall, after three attempts, he was finally murdered at his home in 1955. However, in my book, he survives that murder attempt, and it's 1985. I've changed his actual birth start, and he's 85 years old, and he still thinks people want to kill him, and really nobody does. So it's kind of a fun look at his life and where he is there.
I can't imagine. And,
so it's kind of a comic novel, but it does go back and tell the whole story of Tampa's mob history through Charlie's eyes. You know,
some
from
real
the turn
stuff.
Of the century.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, what does he do? He goes down and he gets a job like working for, you know, Thrive Downtown St. Pete or, you know.
Charlie's has a way
the
of
Palladium
making,
Theater.
Has a way of making money.
Yeah.
And Charlie made enough. I mean, he lost so much in the, and he would have, this would have really happened if he hadn't been killed. Most of his money was in Cuba banks and things like that. He made more money than anybody.
Was he Cuban? Was his
family? No. He was a WASP. That's what made it interesting is that Charlie was from, he was a member of Gasparilla. His family were very prestigious. There are still walls in Tampa, and they're related to the Likes and the McKays, but he was the black sheep.
Yeah.
And he went his own way. Charlie never had to worry about money. Charlie's worries were more about getting shot.
Wow.
But he had a very colorful life, and he shows up still. Laurie Roy's new book has a Charlie Wall cameo. And so anyway, and I talked to somebody else who's working on a story about his murder. So I'm just happy to get this book out there.
Is it finished? Is it ready?
It's finished. I just got, I always hire an editor, a national type editor.
Sure.
To help me, and I've got all that back, and now I'm going through and working through those changes. But it's 100,000 words. It'll be ready for 2025. But I am going to try to shop it to some agents to see if there's a national thing. And if not, we love St. Pete Press, and it'll come out in St. Pete Press.
I love St. Pete Press.
I do too.
I do. So you want to slip us a title? You know what you're going to call it?
Right now it's called The Everlasting Life of Charlie Wall.
Mm-hmm. We'll see if that doesn't change. We talk about this all the time, but I remember Florida Hustle originally had a different title.
Oh, it had many titles.
You were throwing around How Don Dies for the longest time.
And someone said, no death in your title.
Yeah, it was a little.
But life is good. Anyway, I don't know. This title will likely change, but right now it's just getting the book as good as I can make.
Charlie Wall. Threw up a well and kept everybody out.
You got to love him.
There you go. Paul Wilburn, always a pleasure. A pleasure and a half, I would say, to sit and chat with you. And, you know, I wish you continued success on the mini tour for Cigar City 5.
Thank you, Bill.
I don't know what else to say.
That's all we really need to say. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Give my best to the missus, and we'll see you soon.
All right. Thank you.